The Upper Big Branch mining disaster was one of the most tragic mining accidents of our lifetime. April 5th marks the 10th anniversary of Upper Big Branch, which killed 29 men. Many of their families and the miners who survived argue that poor working conditions led to this tragedy, which they say should have been prevented.
You had the power to prevent this disaster and you did nothing. You had an unwarrantable failure on your watch.
Upper Big Branch also marked a test of our justice system and how we hold CEOs responsible for workplace fatalities, or in most cases, don't. We'll look back at the significance of the case against former Massey CEO Don Blankenship. Judy Jones Peterson, whose brother Dean Jones was killed in the Upper Big Branch mine explosion in 2010, was at the courthouse to hear the verdict.
And most importantly, we say never again. This case sends a message to all CEOs, owners, and operators. You are on notice. You are responsible for the health and safety of your members.
This week on Inside Appalachia, we look back at what the past 10 years has taught us. Ten years ago, on April 5th, 2010, 29 men who worked at an underground mine in Raleigh County, West Virginia, lost their lives. The Upper Big Branch Mining Memorial Group, Inc. has placed wreaths at the monument in Raleigh County on April 5th every year. But this year, they aren't encouraging family members to visit due to the spread of COVID-19. Family members are memorializing their loved ones in their own ways. While the annual events at Marsh Fork Elementary, the Upper Big Branch Monument, and other places across the region can't happen as they usually do because of the spread of COVID-19, loved ones still have social media as a way to remember. Some of them keep photos up throughout the year as their cover photo on Facebook. Some remember them with old photos on their birthdays or sharing memories. Over the years, some people have tagged the names of loved ones who had Facebook pages to write a note and let them know a song made them think of them. Many of them share all of the victims' names. Songwriter Stacy Grubb and her father Alan Cathead Johnston wrote this song called Montcole, West Virginia, about the lives that were lost.
On the fifth day of April, 2010, death came again. 29 men and took away the spirits like a feather in the wind.
In Montcole, West Virginia.
Didn't give a warning, didn't give a sign, didn't see it coming. They were took down from behind by that methane devil.
Stacy Grubb's song is just one example of how we can still connect with each other and pay tribute to the 29 men who died 10 years ago at Upper Big Branch. Today, we're reflecting back on what happened and exploring some of the ways family members, artists, and our communities memorialize one of the most tragic mining disasters in modern history. At the end of our show, we'll hear from artists who wrote a play featuring the music of Steve Earle. The play was inspired by the stories from the family members. Some of these moments are hard to hear, but on this show, we think it's important to remember the lives lost and the families who continue to suffer. So as we recap the story and hear a few new ones, I hope you'll journey with us and remember with us. When I spoke with some of the family members back in 2015, many told me they've never really had closure or felt justice was served. Investigations after the mining disaster revealed that the 29 men died because safety protocols at the mine were not enforced. To start things off, let's listen back to a story from 2010, just a week after the tragedy at Upper Big Branch. NPR's Howard Berkus uncovered that Massey Energy's mines had a high rate of injury, more than twice the national rate.
The NPR news analysis shows that Massey Energy's litany of safety violations, citations, and fines goes beyond the Upper Big Branch mine, where 29 miners died last week in the deadliest mine disaster in 40 years. Upper Big Branch is among 10 Massey mines cited for safety problems last year more than 2,400 times, according to federal mine safety records. And Massey's long list of citations has some wondering whether the federal inspection system works.
Part of the strategy, I guess you'd want to call it, by the mine operators are, well, we're going to contest everything.
Bruce Dial is a mine safety consultant and veteran federal inspector. In the last 4 years, he says, in the wake of the Sago mine disaster, inspections, citations, and fines increased.
And it takes so long to get it through review commissions. They don't end up paying fines until it's 3, 4, 5 years down the road.
In fact, 16,000 citation appeals are pending worth millions in fines. Massey Energy alone had more than $7 million in fines in the last 5 years at its high-injury mines, and it's paid less than a third of the fines so far. Massey did not respond to NPR's request for comment, but said in a statement last week that its rate of violations at Upper Big Branch is consistent with the national average. That's not true, according to Ellen Smith of Mine Safety and Health News.
The industry average is actually 0.71, and that particular mine has a 0.94 violations per inspection day. So that mine is about 30% higher than the average underground bituminous coal mine.
Smith thinks the problem lies in liability. Right now, she says, mine supervisors, foremen, and mine companies as a whole can face criminal penalties for serious safety violations, but not company presidents or CEOs.
There will be a different safety culture if they know that there's a chance that they might spend 6 months in jail or they might have charges personally brought against them. But at this point, there is nothing in the law that would allow that to happen.
The law does permit the Mine Safety and Health Administration to shut down a mine if there's a pattern of serious violations, but that kind of drastic action is rare. The agency also declined comment for this story, saying top officials were traveling to a memorial service for the miners killed last week. Dennis O'Dell of the United Mine Workers Union compares the safety inspection system to driving drunk, but without the threat of a suspended license.
And I can drive, drink, get pulled over, contest it, until eventually I kill somebody or kill myself. And that's what's going on in the mine. And until we fix that, we're going to continue those operators to drive, drink, and kill.
Mining companies say they have to challenge citations because the fines are far higher now. And before recent changes, they could negotiate reduced fines and sanctions with federally appointed mediators. That's according to Luke Popovich of the National Mining Association.
When they removed an opportunity to contest these at a lower level, that created a positive incentive for operators to contest them the only way they could.
Some of Massey's safety violations involve improper ventilation of methane gas and excessive buildup of coal dust, and those are precisely the conditions that could have triggered last week's deadly explosion. But no cause is known for certain yet. The investigations are just getting underway. And there was this news yesterday as recovery crews prepared to remove the last of the bodies from the Upper Big Branch mine. S&P Equity Research said the financial impact of this deadly mine disaster will be immaterial. Massey Energy stock, the advisory said, is again worth buying.
That was NPR's Howard Berkus reporting in 2010, just after the Upper Big Branch mine explosion killed 29 men. Today we're looking back at this story to mark the 10th anniversary of the tragedy. A year after the explosion, an investigation into the mining disaster revealed that Massey's unsafe working conditions were likely largely to blame. Again, here's Howard Berkus speaking with NPR's host, Michelle Norris.
Now, the report was produced by an independent investigative team that was appointed by Joe Manchin, who was governor of West Virginia at the time. He's now senator. And this team spent a year alongside state and federal investigators as they conducted more than 200 interviews and they gathered evidence underground. This team was led by former Federal Mine Safety Chief David McAteer, and they did not mince words in their report. Massey Energy, they said, normalized a culture of deviance, putting production and profits before the safety of its own coal miners. This company operated in a profoundly reckless fashion, this report said.
And how exactly did that happen? What did these investigators find?
There was a litany of failures, a failure to ventilate the mine properly so that explosive methane gas and explosive coal dust would be harmlessly swept away. There was a failure to keep water sprays working on the massive cutting tool so that sparks would be controlled. There was a failure to spread crushed limestone throughout the mine. That limestone neutralizes the explosive power of coal dust. And there's actually a lot more, but it all adds up to the very things that triggered this explosion and then fed a series of explosions that coursed through the mine more than 2 miles.
And as we said, this investigation also cast a harsh light on the Mine Safety and Health Administration. What about the federal regulators?
Yeah, you know, this explosion, the investigator said, is proof positive that the Mine Safety Agency failed in its duty as the watchdog for coal miners. The report says the agency failed to see the big picture of these many catastrophic failures that were occurring at the mine. And as we have reported, this agency failed to use its toughest enforcement tools on this mine or any other mine before the explosion, tools it had never used before.
What's the response from the Mine Safety Agency and from Massey Energy?
You know, I talked to Assistant Secretary of Labor Joe Maine today, and the first thing he tried to do was lay all the blame on Massey Energy. I really pressed him on this point, and he finally did accept some responsibility. He did say that the agency has acted much tougher since the explosion, and it has to some degree. Now, Massey Energy didn't address any of the specific criticisms. The company said it is reviewing the report, but it did revive claims that coal dust was not a factor in the explosion, and this report contradicts that claim with page after page of evidence.
NPR's Howard Berkus is in Beckley, West Virginia, as part of an NPR News investigation into the Upper Big Branch mine disaster. Howard, thank you very much.
You're welcome, Michelle.
Massey Energy was bought by Alpha Natural Resources the same year this report was published. Alpha filed for bankruptcy in 2015, the same year that federal prosecutors brought a case against former Massey CEO Don Blankenship. A jury found him guilty of conspiring to violate federal mine safety standards, a misdemeanor. He served a year of jail time for that charge. Blankenship was found not guilty on 2 counts of securities fraud, felonies that carried much heavier sentences. I imagine that for family members who lost brothers, who lost husbands, fathers, it must be devastating to relive this tragedy year after year. With each new report or trial, they again have had to confront their loss. Many of these family members chose to be there, day in and day out, when Don Blankenship stood trial. Many were there when the verdict was read on December 3, 2015. Judy Jones Peterson lost her brother in the Upper Big Branch mine disaster. After the verdict was announced, Jones stood on the steps of the federal courthouse in Charleston and addressed a crowd of reporters.
I want to thank the jury for making this decision. To Mr. Blankenship, I say you now wear a cloak of criminal shame. Though you're not convicted on all counts, you are convicted here. You are judged here as a liar, a cheat, and fraud. History, however, will judge you for your true crime, the reckless disregard of human life and the negligent homicide of 29 innocent souls purely out of your own selfish greed.
Peterson said she also hopes this historic verdict will make companies increase safety precautions for all workers.
And most importantly, we say never again. This case sends a message to all CEOs, owners, and operators. You are on notice. You are responsible for the health and safety of your members.
But Peterson did not lay blame entirely on Blankenship. She also blames his former top mining officials at Massey and the federal organization charged with protecting the health and safety of miners.
To MSHA, the Mine Health and Safety Administration, you failed miserably to do the job entrusted to you to assure the health and safety of our lost loved ones. You let a rogue organization operate way outside the scope of the law. UBB had more unwarrantable failures than any other coal mines in the United States of America, and you allowed them to conduct business as usual, putting countless lives at risk. We hold you as responsible for the loss of our loved ones as Don Blankenship and his henchmen. You had the power to prevent this disaster, and you did nothing. You had an unwarrantable failure on your watch. We asked President Obama and his labor secretary to do a blitz investigation of your organization. We asked them to clean up your house.
And Tony Opegard agrees that MSHA is partly to blame for the Upper Big Branch disaster. Opegard is an attorney from Kentucky who has represented minors and their families for about 30 years. He also served as advisor to the Assistant Secretary of Labor for the Federal Mine Safety and Health Administration. I spoke with him just after Blankenship's verdict was announced.
Blankenship was an outlaw coal operator, a rogue operator for years and years and years. And MSHA did not do enough to rein him in. Who knows why? You know, he was a powerful guy. Some people in MSHA in the district level were too close to him. That may have had something to do with it.
Opegard pointed out that since the Upper Big Branch blast in 2010, MSHA has made some changes. He said one action he applauded is more frequent inspections called mine blitzes or impact inspections.
A blitz is when you send multiple inspectors to a mine. They take control of the phone so that nobody can call underground to say, you know, you have inspectors outside who are coming in. And they fan out over the mine. Say there's two or three working sections in a mine. The inspectors will go to each section at the same time. And that's the only way that MSHA inspectors truly see the working conditions of miners.
Hours after the verdict, the United Mine Workers of America sent out a release in which President Cecil Roberts said, quote, "A message has gone out today to every coal operator in America who is willing to skirt mine safety and health laws. You do so at your own personal risk." But did the verdict change anything? Did it make it safer for miners to go to work? It depends on who you ask. When we spoke back in 2015, Opegard said he had little hope that the verdict would affect other operators. He said Blankenship is one of a kind.
The only CEOs or presidents of coal companies that I've known in all the years I've been doing mine safety work who were as intimately involved as Mr. Blankenship was at Upper Big Branch are owners of very small mines. So, for instance, I was a mine safety prosecutor in Kentucky. We had an accident. This was back in the early 2000s where a miner was killed. And the guy who owned the mine worked there every day. He was an electrician. He was outside every day. He went underground on occasion. And, he was charged, criminal charges filed against him. And he was convicted and he went to jail for a short period of time. And that itself was very unusual, but that's at a small mine. So when you talk about CEOs, you're usually talking about these major coal companies. And in that sense, I mean, Mr. Blankenship's just totally different than anyone else. Most CEOs of major coal companies, you know, sit in Pittsburgh or New York or Philadelphia or St. Louis, wherever. They're nowhere near the mine, the coal fields. They're not near the mine. They have other people dealing with those day-to-day small details of operating the mine. And Blankenship was different. And that's why I don't think that the verdict is going to send shivers down the spines of other coal mine company presidents and CEOs. I really think it's going to be limited to the facts of this case. Had it happened 25 years ago, maybe it would have more of an impact. But I don't think it will have a major impact now on the coal industry or how people do business for those mines that are still in operation that have survived this this slump in the mining business.
But perhaps the verdict did bring some closure for the families. Shirley Witt, whose brother Boone Payne died at Upper Big Branch, says she didn't expect to have closure until after Blankenship's sentencing. She spoke to Ashton Mara, who was then a reporter with West Virginia Public Broadcasting at the courthouse after the verdict in 2015.
Cheryl, how are you feeling today? How are you feeling?
Disappointed.
Right?
Disappointed, but somewhat relieved that it wasn't a hung jury. I'm glad he was guilty. We know, everyone knows he was guilty of conspiracy. So he's not walking away from this, even though it's a misdemeanor. But when they said not guilty on the other two, it was kind of like someone just hit you in the stomach.
Still, Witt said she's relieved the verdict doesn't allow Blankenship to come out completely blame-free.
He could have walked away not guilty of all three charges. So just for him to be brought to this and know that he wasn't in control, to me that's worth it, just to see him sit there every day and have to listen of the kind of person he was. That kind of gave me some, I felt like that was speaking for all the 29 miners that passed away.
So the judge will have the final decision in sentencing, and it's a misdemeanor charge, so it could just be a fine. It could be up to a year in prison. What would you say to her as she starts to consider this?
I hope she considers that the evidence was so strong that this man should not be able to walk away with a fine. A fine doesn't mean anything to Don Blankenship, unless you're talking about hundreds of millions, and it's not going to be that. What would affect Don Blankenship is to go to prison for a year.
One reporter asked Witt what she thought of Blankenship's demeanor after the jury verdict came in. Witt said she didn't feel justice has entirely been served in the Blankenship case.
I look around and I looked at his lawyers. They did a good job. But money does talk. If that had been me up there, they would have put me in prison for the rest of my life if I had done what this man has done. So
just to hear the words guilty was important to me.
I think that's all I have. I'm just drained. It's been a long 2.5 months and a long 5.5 years.
Just to be clear, technically this verdict didn't mean Blankenship has been blamed for causing the Upper Big Branch disaster. He was accused of conspiring to violate mine safety standards and conspiring to impede mine safety officials, not for causing the deaths of the 29 men. In 7 weeks of testimony, U.S. Attorney Booth Goodwin's office called 27 witnesses, including several former Upper Big Branch miners. The defense rested its case without calling a single witness. Scott Halstead is a former miner at Upper Big Branch. He testified during the trial and spoke with me outside of the courthouse.
Why did you say you were doing this today?
I'm doing it for the 29 that perished. You know, they were my closest. They were my close friends, you know, I worked with them every day. You know, it was just like family, you know, every morning you sit and you talk about your families and conditions of the mines and you know, it was just a close-knit outfit, you know. And when you lose one, you know, you lose a part of yourself. And I just wanted to do what was right. You know, it's all I could do to, you know, help the families of the ones that lost their loved ones.
Halstead says the past few years have been hard for him, and speaking out wasn't something he felt safe to do before. And he hopes his testimony sends a message to other coal miners, too.
Don't take nothing for granted. You know, you got the right to do what is right, and, you know, with the way mining is today, you can't take nothing for granted. You know, it can happen in an instant. No matter how safe you are at a mine, there's always something that can happen in just a blink of an eye.
Speaking up about poor safety conditions was something that was basically unheard of at this Massey-owned mine in West Virginia before the disaster in 2010. Steve Morgan testified before Congress just 2 months after he lost his son, Adam Morgan, in the blast.
I said to him, you think it's unsafe and you want to be put out by in a safer area, go to the trainee, see what they tell you. The boss pulled him to the side there by himself and told him, said, if you're going to be that scared of your job, or you need to rethink your career.
There were two survivors of the disaster. One of them was Stanley Goose Stewart. Goose gave some of the most emotional testimony in the case, breaking down on the stand as he remembered the code of silence UBB miners followed. He spoke with me in 2012.
Working under Massey, they didn't care. For some reason, they seemed like that was in their agenda to just break the rules, and they didn't have to follow the law. It was like they had a mentality that the laws were stupid.
Our newsroom at West Virginia Public Broadcasting covered the entirety of the trial. We produced a podcast called Blankenship on Trial. On the eve of the verdict in December 2015, two of West Virginia Public Broadcasting's staff and producers of the podcast, Ashton Mara and Scott Finn, sat down and recorded this conversation about the verdict, its implications, and what came next. Also joining them was Charleston attorney and former assistant U.S. attorney Mike Hissom.
So, Mike, are you surprised at all to hear the verdict was split in this way?
I'm not, Scott. Counts 2 and 3, which charged a false statement filed with the SEC in a press release and securities fraud to the investing public in a press release after the explosion, were novel and difficult charges, and based on the notes that the jury sent out during the trial, something that they struggled with. Charging as crimes, broad, somewhat general statements in a press release. As to count one, it's a conspiracy, which is, as we've talked about before, a broad tool for federal prosecutors to use. And the question of the penalty, which object of the conspiracy the jury selected, was something that honestly may not have been abundantly clear to the jury. They weren't told that the penalty would change so dramatically based on which check mark they put next to which line. And they checked the first line, which is the conspiracy, the object of which was to violate the federal mine safety standards. They did not check the second line, which was a conspiracy to defraud MSHA, Mine Safety and Health Administration. And had they checked that second box, it would have been a 5-year statutory maximum penalty, and a much more significant, a felony, a much more significant crime. But I don't think it's surprising at all that the jury came down that way.
And so it's important to note here that it ended up being a misdemeanor crime that he was convicted of, and not the other felonies that they could have convicted him of, as you're saying. Ashton, the U.S. Attorney's Office spent 5 years investigating this case. After all this time, was U.S. Attorney Booth Goodwin satisfied with the outcome?
He says that he was. Mr. Goodwin held a press conference after the verdict, and he said he and his team of attorneys in the office, they were celebrating the verdict. He called it a victory. Here's a portion of what he had to say.
I'm not in any way disappointed with this result. I think it brings justice, justice that was long overdue in this case. I think the most serious conduct, certainly, that he was involved in, that is the defendant, was willfully violating the mine safety laws and placing his miners, those who work for him, at risk. So certainly, I think that the jury's verdict speaks volumes in this case.
So Mike, you were involved as a former assistant U.S. attorney in the initial phases of this investigation before Blankenship was involved, but still the upper big branch investigation. You've worked for and with Booth Goodwin, the U.S. attorney in this. What is your assessment of how they prosecuted this case?
I think Booth Goodwin, and honestly, from his swearing-in ceremony about a month after the explosion, Scott, made it clear that he was going to take a fresh look. And as we've talked about before, he was going to have the FBI, not MSHA, he was going to have the FBI run this investigation, and that he was going to seek to hold individuals accountable, and that he was going to go higher up the corporate chain. And the takeaway from Booth Goodwin and from Steve Ruby, the assistant United States attorney who was the first chair lawyer at Mr. Blankenship's trial and who's led this investigation, their takeaway will be that they did that. That they, for them, it will be mission accomplished. They convicted the CEO of a publicly traded coal company for mine safety violations, for a conspiracy to break the mine safety laws. That will be their talking point. And there are two prosecutors who do not focus particularly on the number of days that any particular defendant is going to serve in a federal penitentiary. They focus instead on convictions and on convictions of some significance. And for them, they will consider that to have been victory.
Right. I think that came across pretty clearly in the press conference as well. Steve Ruby made a brief statement at the end of the press conference and said that you can't judge justice by the length of time a defendant or someone who is convicted will spend in jail. Another thing that I think is important to consider when it comes to the sentencing, though, is Judge Berger herself. And she doesn't necessarily have a reputation for being a light sentencer. And so coming up with a 12-month sentence, I'm not sure that that's unreasonable for us to believe that she'll do.
So, Ashton, Mr. Blankenship was not let out of the courthouse and sent to jail, right? Could you explain what happened and what's going to happen next?
Right. So after the verdict was given, Steve Ruby made a motion that he would like to have Don Blankenship detained. He said that he poses a flight risk. That basically he has, although he had to give up his passport as part of the original bond, he has the ability to leave the country if he really wants to. He has basically the financial means to do so. He moved to have him detained. And then he said, if you're not going to detain him, we'd like to impose a $10 million bond and home confinement. But Judge Berger basically said, you know, Mr. Blankenship has been cooperative. He's been present at every hearing. He's been attentive. And she didn't see any reason to change any part of his bond. So the original bond has been kept in place. It's a $5 million cash bond. He's given up his passport. He's not getting that back. And he has travel restrictions placed on him. He'll have to stay in the Southern District of West Virginia. He's allowed to go to Pike County, Kentucky, and to D.C., where his attorneys are located.
And of course, he will be appealing. We heard from his lead attorney, Bill Taylor, who said that they plan to do that as soon as possible.
Right. So today was really the first time that we got to hear from Taylor at all. And he was critical of both the prosecution and of Judge Berger's rulings in the statements that he made.
Well, we have a lot of grounds for appeal that go back to the insufficiency of the indictment in the first place, not to mention evidentiary rulings and so forth. So this is a record which will be very full of errors on appeal. I'm as confident as I've ever been that the Court of Appeals will reverse the conviction.
Mike, what do you think of the defense's chances of getting this reversed?
I think they're extraordinarily difficult. The current makeup of the Fourth Circuit, the Fourth Circuit has historically been a difficult case for a difficult court for a defendant to succeed in obtaining a reversal of conviction. And given the current makeup of the 15 judges who serve on the Fourth Circuit Court of Appeals, I think it would be very difficult for Don Blankenship to reverse this misdemeanor conviction. I think the Fourth Circuit will take a close look at it. I think that they will allow him oral argument, which is not something that they do in every case, but I think in a case of this high profile, they will. But I think that he will be fighting an uphill battle.
What are the issues that you expect them to appeal?
I think one of the first ones, and something that bothered them and has been a big issue, is the omission of the citations, the actual IMSHA citations being admitted into evidence when they weren't issued to Don Blankenship and Don Blankenship didn't see them. That's something that was commented on throughout by the defense team. One of the other things is the inability through the government's witnesses to play videos that they called exculpatory that helped Don Blankenship, and they were videos of particularly a safety meeting at Scott High School that the company put on to stress the importance of safety. I think it's also safe to assume that the defense will renew their attack on the failure of the judge to sever count one, the count that led to a conviction, from counts two and three. Counts two and three were important, very important to this trial, even though they did not result in a conviction, because they allowed the government to talk about the explosion at Upper Big Branch, because the press release followed the explosion. And they allowed the government to talk about Don Blankenship's immense personal wealth and his stock options and play many recordings that were very unfavorable to Don Blankenship. Given that he was acquitted on counts two and three, I think that'll be a focus to say these were improper. The jury didn't even convict on them, and it tainted the trial for the jury to hear these two categories of evidence. It tainted their verdict on count one.
So, Ashton, you've been covering this thing from the very beginning. What are some of the impressions of this trial that you're going to take away?
I think that maybe it's just because of what I do and who I am, but the things that stick out to me are those emotional moments where I connected with people. So probably because it's still fresh in my mind, but sitting with the family members as we waited for the jury to deliberate. That's something that will always stick out to me. The testimony of the miners who worked underground, who testified about these conditions that they had to work in, specifically the miner who said that he had to walk through water up to his chest. And then, of course, Bill Ross. His testimony was so emotional that you could tell that he truly wanted to make a difference. I think those emotional moments, those are the ones that are going to stick with me the longest.
That was Ashton Marr speaking with Scott Finn and former Assistant U.S. Attorney Mike Hissom back in December 2015. They produced a podcast during the entirety of Blankenship's trial, which I highly recommend listening to if you'd like to learn more about this case. You can find it at wvpublic.org or search for Blankenship on Trial wherever you get your podcasts. Today on Inside Appalachia, we've been hearing reactions to the verdict in the Don Blankenship trial. Family members of the Upper Big Branch mine disaster are still grieving for their loved ones, and of course, no verdict is going to make that grief go away. Blankenship received the maximum sentence for his misdemeanor charge of conspiring to violate federal mine safety laws. His sentence, 1 year in prison and a $250,000 fine. Blankenship served his sentence in prison and was released in May 2017. In 2018, he ran for U.S. Senate as a Republican, but lost in the primary race. He was running for the seat currently held by West Virginia Senator Joe Manchin. He has asked for his case to be overturned, but judges dismissed his motion in January of this year. Up next, a new play tells the story of the Upper Big Branch mine disaster. The show, which features original songs by Steve Earle, has been put on pause because of the coronavirus pandemic, but the playwrights say they want to, eventually, bring the production to Appalachia. You're Inside Appalachia. I'm Jessica Lilly.
Support for Inside Appalachia is provided by Concord University in Athens, West Virginia. With career-focused liberal arts education in more than 80 degrees and programs to pursue various career options, not just a single job. More at concord.edu.
Today on Inside Appalachia, we're looking back at this tragic story of the Upper Big Branch mine disaster and how we can honor those who lost their lives by reflecting on some of the lessons that were learned following this tragedy. Some of the lessons are tough to absorb. That these deaths likely could have been prevented if mine inspectors had fulfilled their duty to protect miners. If folks at Massey Energy had been more rigorous with safety and valued human life over productivity. We also learned, however, that our justice system doesn't have much leeway when it comes to trying those who knowingly put workers at risk. It's been suggested that our laws need tightening to more strictly enforce worker safety rules and regulations. Then again, the coal industry has been hit with devastating losses over the past 10 years. Coal industry advocates say tightening regulations could further cripple the industry. Instead, many argue that these regulations should actually be loosened, and in fact, they have during President Trump's administration. But in the 10 years since Upper Big Branch, despite the outcry to improve safety, more than 130 miners have lost their lives across the U.S. Sure, the numbers are decreasing, but that's due in part to the fact that coal mining employment has also decreased in the past decade. For Patty Quarles, who lost her son Gary Wayne Quarles, she tells me that on this 10th anniversary of her death son, it's like the first day she got the horrific news, and the pain is at times unbearable. Because of the coronavirus, families aren't supposed to gather in big crowds this year to honor their loved ones. The pandemic has also impacted a play about the families affected by the tragedy. It's called Coal Country, and it was being run at an off-Broadway playhouse in New York City. The dialogue is drawn from interviews with people who worked in the Upper Big Branch mine and those who lost family members there. Jeff Young of the Ohio Valley Resource spoke with playwrights just before the production was paused.
In the play Coal Country, actors address the audience directly from a spare set. They recall the Upper Big Branch disaster and the loss it left behind.
I had 34 years in coal mining. My dad was a coal miner, grandpa, dad, me, and then my son Gary Wayne.
Ambulances galore, fire trucks, police cars, state troopers. And I literally fell to the floor.
I got a video of Corey on my computer. He shot it underground to explain to his girlfriend what he'd done every day. And I sit there and I cry from time it starts to time it finishes.
The characters are based on real people. Nearly every word of dialogue comes directly from people who worked in the Upper Big Branch mine or who lost family members there. The playwrights, Jessica Blank and Eric Jensen, call it documentary theater. Shortly after the play opened, the husband and wife team invited me to their Brooklyn apartment and settled into a sofa to explain their work process. At first, Blank said, she wondered if she would even get people to agree to talk with her. They were not returning her calls.
And I finally figured out after a couple of weeks of this, I said, you know, I think that this is a community where you have to show your face. And, you know, that just getting a phone message from some person in New York being like, hey, I'm doing a project. Do you want to talk to us? Isn't going to do the trick.
So in April 2016, she traveled to a Charleston, West Virginia courthouse. There she sat with family members of victims as Massey Energy's CEO, Don Blankenship, was sentenced for conspiracy to violate mine safety rules.
I think what happened is that word got around that we were okay after those first few interviews, because then we started sitting down with more and more folks.
I'm from the rural Midwest, and you know, grew up in a small town.
That's Eric Jensen.
And so, like, I immediately related to people kind of on that level. You know, I felt very, even though I'm from Minnesota, I felt very, very connected to West Virginia. And West Virginians are just amazing storytellers anyway, so.
Like, every experience we had sitting with every person we sat down with was incredibly powerful and incredibly eye-opening and incredibly moving. I mean, I learned so much from everyone that we talked to. We learned a lot about coal mining. We learned a lot firsthand about unions and deunionization and the deunionization of this particular area. And, you know, I mean, we learned a lot about humanity, as we often do when we do this kind of project.
My thing about it was I learned a lot about grief. But during the course of doing this, I lost both my dad and my uncle. And I think that was when I finally understood what we were writing and finally understood what it was like to be in that community. And it broke my heart open. And thank God for Steve's music.
Steve is singer-songwriter Steve Earle, who is also on stage during the performances. He's a sort of one-man Greek chorus whose songs echo the character's loss and hint at deeper themes. In this reworking of the ballad John Henry, for example, Earl weaves in stories of the decline of union representation among coal miners.
Well, union come and tried to make a stand. West Virginia miners voted union to a man. You'd never know it now, and that was then. The union come and tried to make a stand.
It occurred to me watching this in an audience that I presume is mostly New Yorkers that this is an opportunity to perhaps overcome another divide in the country, which is the strong divide between urban and rural America now. Do you think you're moving the needle on that discussion at all with this work?
I certainly hope so.
That would be a privilege. That would be a privilege to move the needle on that discussion.
I certainly hope so. I think it is a needle that needs to be moved. The things that people say sometimes about the rural working class otherwise really thoughtful people are shocking to me. And I think it's a really big blind spot that mostly comes from not having any contact.
You know, people have dignity. People have history. You know, whether you're pro coal or against coal or whatever, like, coal miners helped build this country.
Built the buildings that we're sitting in.
You know, and coal miners helped build this country, and they should be treated as such. And right now what they're doing is they're blocking trains with their bodies in order to get their benefits or in order to get their last paycheck. And I just think workers should be treated better than that.
Eric Jensen and Jessica Blank wrote the play Coal Country about the Upper Big Branch disaster. For the Ohio Valley Resource, I'm Jeff Young.
The songs that are featured in Coal Country were all written by the legendary Steve Earle. And I think it's a good example of how these stories live on and how this tragedy is still being retold and remembered a decade later. Steve Earle performed one of the songs from the play earlier this year when he performed on Mountain Stage. Let's listen.
My daddy was a miner. My daddy's daddy too. Union God and country was all we ever knew. We were up from early morning till the evening whistle blew. When they strike the mine, you walk the line, cause that's just what you do. When you're born in West Virginia, a miner through and through. Union God and country was all you ever knew. And it's Union God and country, West Virginia, golden blue. Union God and country is all we have. Now before there was a union, the company was king. You'd work your fingers to the bone, couldn't show a thing. You tried to fight, you'd draw your payment in. You'd walk down to the company store, give it back again. And that's why they'd made the union. They had nothing left to lose. Union, God, and country was all they ever knew. It was Union, God, and country, West Virginia, golden blue. Union, God, and country was all they ever knew. Union, God, and country, West Virginia, golden blue. Union, God, and country was all they ever knew. It was Union, God, and country, West Virginia, golden blue. Union, God, and country was all they ever knew.
The Upper Big Branch explosion took the lives of 29 men. One of those men was Gary Wayne Quarles. His mother, Patty, sent me a message this week. She said she usually goes to a memorial at Marsh Fork Elementary School. It's held around a tree that was planted at the grade school for the memory of all the miners. Patty says Gary Wayne's former teacher still shares his story with other students every year, even though he's retired. She usually puts a rose on the monument in Whitesville and admits she still does a lot of crying. She visits his grave to clean around the headstone and change the flowers. She says the anniversary is a hard day, but really, every day is. But this year, she says it is different. With the 10th anniversary, she tells me she realizes people might be thinking about all the families, but because of the coronavirus, everyone should think about their health and their family and stay home. This year, her grandkids are going to put roses on the monuments. Patty plans to go out when the pandemic is over. To end her message, Patty thanked me for always remembering. And that's what we wanted to do on this show. And so, here they are, the names of the 29 men who lost their lives on April 5th, 2010, when explosions rocked the Upper Big Branch mine. Carl Calvin Akard, Jason Adkins, Christopher Bell, Gregory Stephen Brock, Kenneth Chapman, Robert E. Clark, Charles Timothy Davis, Corey Thomas Davis, Michael Lee Cuz Elswick, William Bob Griffith, Stephen Smiley Hara, Edward Dean Jones, Richard K. Lane, William Roosevelt Lynch, Nicholas Darrell McCroskey, Joe Markham, Ronald Lee Maynor, James Eddie Mooney, Adam Keith Morgan, Rex Mullins, Joshua Scott Napper, Howard D. Boone Payne, Dillard Earl Persinger, Joel R. Price, Dward Scott, Gary Wayne Quarles, Grover Dale Skeens, Benny Willingham, Ricky Workman. We had help producing Inside Appalachia this week from WUKY in Lexington, Kentucky, and the Ohio Valley Resource, which is made possible with support from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting and West Virginia Public Broadcasting. Our theme music is by Matt Jackford. Other music in today's show was provided by Spencer Elliott, Catherine Clare, Stacy Grubb, and Alan Cathead Johnston with Mod Cole, West Virginia. Our producer is Roxy Todd. Eric Douglas is our associate producer. Brittany Patterson edited our show this week. Our audio mixer is Patrick Stevens. Xander Alloy helped put the show together this week. Our executive producer, Glennis Board. Congratulations to the newest member of her family. Glennis just gave birth at home to a lovely baby boy. Everyone is healthy. Hey, we need some of that good news, right? You can find us on Twitter at InAppalachia. You can also send us an email to insideappalachia@wvpublic.org. Visit wvpublic.org/insideappalachia to sign up for the Inside Appalachia newsletter. There you can also subscribe or download all of our stories or look for the Inside Appalachia podcast wherever you get your podcasts. Inside Appalachia is a production of West Virginia Public Broadcasting. Till next time, thanks for joining me as we journey throughout Appalachia.